Hello, I am Mark Graff with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. For those of you who were not able to join my earlier session, give it a little bit of background on myself. I am NOAA's FOIA officer, as well as the Bureau Chief Privacy Officer here within the Department of Commerce. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has significant volumes of both FOIA and privacy data. And a lot of the times when we are collecting information regarding the acquisitions that are going to take place, we want to do a deeper dive and find out what the impact is going to be. And so I wanted to give a presentation that touches on one solution that NOAA has developed that's allowed us to kill two birds with one stone, really, and to do a more comprehensive peek into the structure and privacy impacts of an acquisition through the use of a tool that we developed known as the Privacy Appendix to the IT Acquisition Checklist. So first I'm going to go over a little bit of the origins of the underlying obligation. It's the statutory premise. What's the basis in OMB Circular A-130? Why is it that we have an IT acquisition checklist, as well as a need to review contracts for privacy impact? Then I'm going to touch on the goals of the IT acquisition checklist as it relates to privacy. What are we trying to accomplish? What questions need to be asked? And then I'm going to dive into the solution itself and outline how it is meant to meet two overlapping requirements that should be on everyone's radar as they are approaching an acquisition that has the potential to impact privacy. And then I'll pause after about 20 minutes, and we should have about 9 or 10 minutes where we can answer questions, if anyone has them. And if not, I'll give the time back to you. So to start out in the origins here, the underlying obligation here, as we think about it, is really a statutory one. What are we thinking through here as we look at our legal obligations from a statutory standpoint? So we'll begin at the broad set and then drill down. So if you think about it as beginning at the broad obligations, at the statutory level, and then drilling down to OMB Circular A-130 obligations, and then to agency or bureau level implementation and procedures to satisfy those requirements. Okay, so the first level in that niveau would be the statutory obligations, which are really derived from 5 U.S.C. 552 A-E-9 and A-E-10. Those are two distinct but very closely related requirements. The first of them is where we have to establish rules of conduct for persons involved in the design, development, operation, or maintenance of any system of records. These are agency obligations, right? To establish these rules of conduct, or in maintaining any record and instruct each such person with respect to such rules and the requirements of this section, including any other rules and procedures that are adopted. So we need to have the rules of conduct. We have to have a structure, is what is mandated by section E9. And then E10 is very similar. Is we have to establish appropriate administrative, technical, and physical safeguards to ensure the security and confidentiality of records and to protect against any anticipated threats or hazards to their security or integrity if it could result in substantial harm, embarrassment, et cetera, to the individual about whom it's maintained. So if those are the what I'd call the electrified fences, the absolute hard stop rules we have to abide by. We have to have established rules of conduct in designing, developing, or maintaining systems that hold our PII, and we have to have administrative and technical and physical safeguards to protect it, right? If I'm summarizing those two sections, that's really what the obligation boils down to. Well, let's dive a little deeper now. So when we look at the next level, so the OMB Circular A130, what's the origin of this obligation here? Now that we're looking at A130, we have to ensure that the terms and conditions in contracts and other agreements involving the creation, collection, use, processing, storage, maintenance, dissemination, disclosure, and disposal of federal information have those security and privacy requirements in place, that they're sufficient to meet our requirements. Remember, I tied those requirements in. What are our requirements? Well, those are set out by E9. Well, and now OMB A130 says, well, now you got to make sure the contracts meet those requirements. Okay, so Appendix 1, Part J1 of OMB Circular A130 marries us to the underlying agency requirements and safeguards set forth, if we have abided by the statute, that were outlined in E9 and E10. This provision of OMB Circular A130 actually has an interesting tie-in also to the statutory requirement of E1. So I'm going to take a tangent here just to kind of loop in one more statutory obligation. The E1 requirement is that we can only maintain records, and by we, I mean a federal executive branch agency, can only maintain records about an individual if it is relevant and necessary to accomplish a purpose of the agency. Okay, that clause, relevant and necessary, ties into the last portion of this section in OMB Circular A130. Sufficient to enable agencies to meet federal and agency specific requirements. All right, that's a little bit of an ambiguity. Are they talking about agency specific requirements set out in section E9 and E10? Or are they talking about the mission of the agency? Either way you cut it, it has a tie-in to the statutory requirement to maintain PII only in as much as it's relevant and necessary to carrying out the mission. And in carrying out the mission, we have to make sure we're abiding by the technical safeguards and the requirements for handling and using PII as it was required under E9 and E10. All right. So a little bit of a cross relation there between OMB Circular A130, Appendix 1, and sections E1, E9, and E10 of the Privacy Act of 1974. We also can look at other sections, of course, of OMB Circular A130 that are relevant and that tie into sufficiency of the contracts and protecting PII that's implicated by an acquisition. So, for example, you have Section 3, Part B, that goes even further, and it says that we have to provide adequate security for all information created, collected, processed, stored, or transmitted on behalf of the agency, which includes those contractors who are acting on our behalf. And then subpart 4 of that same section, it says that they have to cost effectively manage the information security and privacy risks, which includes reducing such risks to an acceptable level. Okay, so now we have the electric fences that are set out by the statute. And then within that, we have a couple of guide rails, right, that keep us on the right path with OMB Circular A130. So now that we have essentially the path laid out in front of us of what we have to do, now we have the framework of what the agency creates. Agencies have broad discretion to choose among alternative methods of securing their records, commensurate with their needs, objectives, procedures, and resources. So really, it's left to the agency to decide, what do you need? What works for your structure, for your resources, for your objectives, for your mission? There was a challenge, actually, a judicial challenge, that tried to argue that the agency had gone off the rails. It was an allegation against the DOJ in Convertino versus DOJ. It was a 2011 case. And the court said, no, the agency has broad discretion to choose what methods of securing this PII are acceptable. They don't have to follow one specific standard agency tool or even public sector tool that might be available in the open market. They can choose what works best for them to make sure that it fits their needs, objectives, procedures, and resources. Interesting that the court pointed out that resources is a consideration in that calculus there. Now, let's move on to what is the underlying obligation with the IT acquisition checklist? What's the goal here? What are we trying to do? In approaching this, I have a bit of a tangent that I want to go into in PAGE versus DIA. Versus DEA. This is a very famous case, not because of the Privacy Act allegations, but because of the underlying fact scenario. Most people who are listening to this have probably seen the YouTube video of the DEA undercover special agent who accidentally shoots himself in the leg while giving a presentation to a group of elementary school students about avoiding drugs and knowing to stay away from guns unless you're properly trained like he is. Let me give a little bit of background. It is an unfortunate case, but that really illustrates well the obligations under privacy. So this is a U.S. Court of Appeals case in January of 2012, but the fact scenario dives back to 2004. So Page is a special agent in DEA's Orlando District office, right? And on Friday, April 9th, 2004, he spoke to a group of about 50 children and parents at a community center in Orlando, Florida. At the time, Page was an undercover agent, and he often would go and speak to the schools and other organizations to educate the public about the dangers of illegal drugs. During this particular presentation, however, Page displayed his DEA-issued firearm while discussing gun safety, and while telling the audience that firearms should be handled only by professionals like himself, his firearm accidentally discharged and he shot himself in the thigh. With Page's knowledge, one of the parents in attendance there had video recorded the presentation, including the accidental discharge. And on a mini DV cassette tape, the event had been recorded. Keep in mind, that is not yet in a Privacy Act system of records. This is a private recording at the time. However, the video was over an hour long in total. The parent turned the mini DV over to the DEA agents who arrived on the scene that night. Later that night, Robert Patterson, who was another DEA special agent from the Orlando District Office, copied the mini DV onto a DHS tape, or excuse me, a VHS tape. Been a long time since I've ever watched a VHS tape. On April 16th, the program analysts at headquarters opened a file for the Page investigation with this particular video recording in it. The file was retrievable by Page's name. For those privacy practitioners, I'm hoping that sets off alarm bells to you that is creating a system of records, or it better had already been in a system of records because it's retrievable by a unique identifier. Right. In late April and early May, Page's accidental discharge was reported to the press. The report stated that a DEA agent had shot himself in the leg, but Page was not identified by name in the press releases. However, a version of the 4-minute and 9-second video began to appear on the internet websites and on the DEA's internal email system at some point between April 2004 and early March 2005. The DEA Office of Professional Review conducted a 1-year-long investigation into the release of the video, but they were never able to determine who released it. The court chastised the DEA. Interestingly, they did not find a cause for damages against Page because they could not show volitional release and dissemination and copying of the video outside of the parameters of the system of records in which it was stored. However, the language was quite stern, and it is a voice of warning because a lot of times contractors or those who are acting under a contract are the ones who are responsible for maintaining these repositories where these databases, where these data points and videos and files are being stored. So the language of the court is the widespread circulation of the accidental discharge video demonstrates the need for every federal agency to safeguard video records with extreme diligence in this internet age of iPhones and YouTube with their instantaneous and universal reach. DEA's treatment of the video recording, particularly the creation of so many different versions and copies, undoubtedly increased the likelihood of disclosure. And although not an abuse of a system of records, I think they could have found an abuse here, but that's my own opinion, is far from a model of agency treatment of privacy data. So if we look at that as the voice of warning, we can move on to the analysis of, well, what are the goals of a privacy act, or excuse me, of an IT acquisition checklist in preventing that, right? Well, before the mandatory BCPO review of contracts was baked into the IT acquisition checklist here at DOC, we still had to review contracts, right? BCPO still had an obligation to do that contract by contract review, but it was performed after the fact, like an audit, okay? And we reported it to Department of Commerce, the Office of Privacy and Open Government. To do that, we had to request to get a copy of each of these contracts from the Acquisition and Grants Office, and we'd do a manual review, and we'd follow up with the ITSO and ISO where the FISMA system was that was impacted by the contract to see whether or not it changed privacy impact assessments. It's a very laborious and time-consuming process. Honestly, the shift here was very welcome on the privacy side, because now anytime that the IT acquisition checklist has items number 2 or 3 marked yes, it triggers a mandatory BCPO review. So I get to see this before the contract is executed, and we don't have to go in after the fact and try to do a mod if there's something about that contract that's not acceptable. Question number 2 of the DOC question number 2 on the IT acquisition checklist is, will any personnel involved in this acquisition perform a function or role that requires access to a system that processes non-public data? And question number 3, DOC question number 3 is, will this acquisition involve government property located at an off-site contractor-controlled facility that'll be used for transmitting, processing, and storing DOC data? If the answer to either of those is yes, it is coming for BCPO review. We started to get a ton of these, and yes, it created an enormous amount of work up front, but we found we already had the obligation to do this, right? Under OMB Circular A130, the underlying obligation to review the contracts was pre-existent from OMB A130 Appendix 1, Part J1 that we talked about before. We already had the obligation to establish appropriate administrative, technical, and physical safeguards. We already had to ensure that terms and conditions in contracts properly considered privacy implications. So now, if I already have the obligation to do the work, this vehicle now just became an opportunity for us to be able to include the contract review and the administrative, technical, and physical safeguard review into one solution. It's a wonderful opportunity for BCPOs. So what does the underlying obligation require, right? What do we already have to do, and how can I bake it into one vehicle? Well, I know when there's going to be a contract that's involving sensitive data, or that's going to involve the handling of sensitive PII, or the transmission of sensitive data with an offsite storage, I have to ask, is there going to be PII? First of all, is the PII new? So that then will answer the question, do I need to create a new SORN or amend an existing SORN? Is there a new Privacy Act statement I have to create to give notice to the individuals providing this PII? Do I have proper consent from the individuals who are providing this PII to the Bureau? Do we already contemplate this kind of collection within the privacy impact assessment? Or is this going to change the privacy risk posture of the FISMA system in which this new data is going to be stored? Next, are all the privacy implications considered? The controls in place, the use, sharing, routine use? Do we have sufficient SORN coverage for this? Do we have sufficient controls in place to protect this vital PII data set? Or do we need to create a POAM and fix it? And it's so much easier to consider that on the front end before the contract has already been executed. Next, about the contract itself. Do we have the right FAR provisions in place? For those who are wondering, we should be looking at subparts 24.1, subpart 24.2, contract clauses found in 52.224-1, 52.224-2. There are the privacy clauses we need to look at of, are these in place so that we ensure ownership of the data, responsibility for handling, things like that. Are they already baked into the contract or do we need to do a mod of the contract? Lastly, are there new privacy issues or contract mods that are needed? And if so, what are they? And then as part of that consideration, the ITSO is the one who is empowered to sign off on it. That is not by coincidence. We designed that because it's ultimately going to be the ITSO and the ISO who have to sign the privacy impact assessment. So if I get a privacy appendix at the time of a contract or of an acquisition where I get the IT acquisition checklist, and it looks different than the PIA, I'm going to reach out to the ITSO and say, why does this contract with the privacy appendix look different and reference a PII that is not listed in the system description of the PIA? It creates an inherent cross-check within our program for privacy to say, I can look at the acquisitions and see what PII is being collected by these contractors. And then I can go over and look at the PIA, both signed by the same person, and say, do they match? Are they collecting the same data? Do they have the right controls? If in the acquisition checklist privacy appendix, it states there's this new privacy risk to the FISMA system, but that's not then reflected in the PIA, I'm able to go back and say, hey, wait a second, it looks like we missed something. It looks like this privacy impact assessment did not consider the acquisition that the same ITSO signed off on. It creates almost a perfect self-checking mechanism to ensure that we consider the privacy implications, not only at the time of contracting in the acquisition checklist with a privacy appendix, but then again, that we can reference those when we perform a privacy impact assessment of the FISMA system in which this PII data will reside. Turned out to be a wonderful solution on our end. So it was reviewed and approved by NOAA AGO, and right now, it has served essentially as an empowerment tool for our ITSOs because now they're able to reach out and identify before the contract is signed the deficiencies. How do we protect the data before we even have it in our doorstep? How do we ensure that the repository is properly encrypted at rest? How do we ensure that the transmission is going to be encrypted in transit and that these are being considered at the pre-contract execution stage, not when we either already have the data in our doorstep or, heaven forbid, when we have a privacy incident. This is properly shifting the empowerment to the ITSO to ask these questions up front and gives them the empowerment to probe and ask what needs to be done to protect this data before we sign this contract. It's a wonderful vehicle. And although there are different ways that this could be done, this is one solution that NOAA has found that has been extremely effective at preventing the improper approval of a contract that doesn't appropriately consider privacy controls and protections, and also at forcing the critical thinking process within the line offices of, how can I do this in a more secure way that has more privacy protections in place? I'll give one brief example before I close off and open to questions. We had one line office that during the pandemic had considered, hey, what about the possibility of having a passive facial recognition scanning tool that will take your temperature and then recognize your face, match you up with your ID as you enter onto one of our NOAA ships. At the outset, I can see the value. I can see why they were thinking this way. It certainly would make it easier to do temperature scanning passively as people enter onto the ship. But when I got this IT acquisition checklist, I reached out to the ITSO and I reached out to the Office of Privacy and Open Government. And we said, is there a less intrusive way to do this? We don't have a system of records notice out that contemplates this precise type of PII collection. And we certainly don't have a privacy impact assessment in place that has referenced this. We'd have to amend a system of records notice and we'd have to amend the privacy impact assessment before this collection could take place. And so we had this wonderful collaborative discussion prior to the contract of ways to do this without collecting any new PII, without doing facial recognition scanning, and without impeding the mission. The ships were still able to launch, but we didn't collect this new PII without having this conversation. And we ended up not collecting the PII at all. We ended up finding a different way to do it. But it was this IT acquisition checklist with the privacy appendix that raised the question. And we found a different way to do it that was not as invasive, that did not collect the PII, that was not necessary to accomplish the mission. It served its purpose. I hope that this solution or a solution like it can be useful to you all as you consider ways to protect the vital privacy data sets that reside within the FISMA systems of the bureaus. Thank you, and I will stop now and pause for, it looks like, 6 minutes of questions. Thank you so much.